bring you up to speed with so much with David. We could spend really just several weeks in his life. We talked about the fact that as far as an Old Testament character is concerned, there's close to a thousand verses that somehow relate to him in some way, references concerning his life. So much of the Old Testament references him in some way, whether it's his life or it's something that relates to him, or whether it's the deity of Christ and the relationship that comes through that. David is saturated throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. And we saw from the very beginning that David was an unlikely king, that as we see that all of his brothers are called up, all of them certainly probably would look better to be a king, David was the last one that his father thought about. We looked at the fact that really, despite him being the next anointed king, as a very young man, what did David do? David doesn't act like I would have acted as a probably 14, 15, 16-year-old. Here he becomes the next anointed king. Whenever Saul is going to be leaving, he'll be in that place. And what does David do? He goes back out to the sheep. He does his father's chores. As I told you the last time, I mean, I kind of hate to say it, but I think it's the truth. As a 15 or 16-year-old, the next time Dad said, take the trash out, I would say, wait a minute, I'm the next king. That wasn't David. David was willing to serve because great leaders, well, they're always willing to serve. And we saw David as he goes and he gets ready to fight Goliath, that he had confidence that he was going to defeat the giant because of what God had done for him in his life. And as he stands in front of King Saul, and Saul tells him, you can't do this. You don't have what it takes. He says, let me tell you what God has done. God has delivered me from the bear and from the lion. With these hands, I've been able to do this because of what God has done for me. And so he takes off that armor, and he goes out there, and he makes it all about God. As Goliath goes on, as he insults David, and as he says all the things that he's been saying, do you remember what David says? He says, you will know the God of Israel. He didn't say, you'll know David and who he is, although certainly that's going to catapult his fame. It's going to be God's glory that's his priority. And he took 5 stones because David was going to persevere. I believe David, as he takes the 5 stones and he takes the staff, he is convinced that, you know, if the first stone doesn't do the job, then I got another stone and another one and all the way through. And if that doesn't work, I've got this staff that David was probably pretty handy with as a shepherd. David's going to hang in there for the whole fight. He's not like you and I. And what I do so often is, God, I'll give it my best effort one time. You know, you get one shot. And so if I'm trying to share the gospel with somebody, or maybe I'm trying to go encourage a member of the church who, you know, maybe that because of characteristics they have in their life, they're kind of hard to encourage sometimes. They don't always take it as they should. And so I go and I try to be nice. I try to be brotherly, and they kind of rebuff and they say something, you know, that's kind of hurtful. And I go, well, Lord, I tried. That's not David. David's willing to persevere. We saw in our last study, as David has opportunities to take the life of King Saul, he doesn't do it. He is gracious towards King Saul. He calls him out. He calls him my Lord. He bows down, even though he had several opportunities to take his life. In the cave, while he's sleeping, David shows great humility. And we say grace is not about pretending a fault didn't happen. David wasn't like, hey, everything's okay, Saul. Saul never even calls him back. Oh, come back with me, David. David doesn't go. David doesn't mistreat him either. And that same man that was so gracious towards King Saul gets insulted by Nabal, the fool. And he's intent on wiping his whole household out. And it was only the wisdom of Abigail that stops him. And remember what she says. She goes, look, you're going to be king one day. You don't need this on your conscience. This is not who you are. I know who you are. And so David is refrained, and he listens to her wisdom. And we said that really, when we talk about submission, even if we're talking about the husband relationship, submission is not going along with everything. It's about going along with what God says. That's what it's really about. And ultimately, man, we need to see the wisdom and the value of a wise woman. Our lesson tonight will be centered around chapter 27 and chapter 29. Just a few verses of chapter 30 is what we'll look at. We'll kind of skip over chapter 28. Not that it's not interesting. The whole witch at Endor with Saul interesting part of the Old Testament, but that's not really what we're about tonight. We're really about David. And what we're going to look at with this man who perhaps up to this point in our three lessons with David, as we see him show such humility and so much service and so much characteristics that are so hard to sometimes relate to my life. I don't see myself as the giant's, you know, killer. Nobody's ever said, Adam, you know, that guy, the man after God's own heart. He's been unrelatable perhaps up to this point. But perhaps tonight, at least for me, I kind of look at some things that we'll see David do and I go, well, there's Adam. Well, there I am right there. David is going to be a man in our story who loses his way. Despite all the promises that God has made him, all that goes out the window in our lesson tonight. And so as he finally collapses under the relentless attacks of Saul. I remember, how many times does Saul say, we're good, David, everything's okay. Then he throws a spear at him. Finally, after all of that, and being on the run with all of his men, finally he is going to collapse. And it's not going to end well for David by the time we get to the end of chapter 27. And we see where he is and what he's doing. We have to keep in mind, he's already been anointed as the next king. He will be just as soon as Saul dies. Here is a man after God's own heart. He's a great man of prayer. You can't get through the Psalms and not see how much David talked to the Lord. But he's going to go away from those very things in our lesson tonight. The very things that we know about David are the things that David's not going to do. And that's when he's going to find himself in trouble. And so here is the question that we'll consider as we get started. What do you and I, based on what we've studied about David already, what do we expect a man like that to do when he gets in trouble? A man who kills Goliath? A man who shows the humility and his service to Saul? What do we expect him to do when he finds himself just overwhelmed? Well, we expect him to just kind of, pull himself up, get himself together, focus on what he should do, and continue just to forge on. That's not what he's going to do. That's not what he's going to do. Let's look at 1 Samuel chapter 27. And let's see what this man says. David said in his heart, now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. What? I thought he was going to replace Saul. Well, that's not David's attitude now. Chapter 27 and verse 1, he says, well, someday Saul's going to kill me. That's what he's convinced of in his heart. And then he says this, there's nothing better for me than I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul would despair of me to seek me anymore in any part of Israel, so I shall escape out of his hand. And him and his 600 men and his wives and his children, they flee. And in verse 4 it says, and it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he sought him no more. The killer of Goliath. The man who has killed lion and bear with his own hands, who trusts in God in circumstances that we perhaps would not, this man runs away. And let's be clear, there's nowhere in the text that suggests that God told him to do so. David said in his own heart that this is what he needs to do. David said, I'm going to die by the hand of Saul. I'm not a big fan of the New Living Translation, but I do like the New Living Translation in this verse. It just simply says, Saul's going to get me. It's plain and simple. This is David. I would suggest to you that 1 Samuel chapter 27 and the mindset is not one of those kind of stories that we often teach our kids in our Sunday school classes in the back about David, right? It's Goliath. It's him forging on. It's all of these great things. It's not this. He runs away. This man who Samuel has already anointed, who Saul has already said that when I die, please be kind to my people. He knows he's the next king. This same guy is running away. The one that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said, look, I'm not going to stand in your way. I know you're the next anointed king. This same guy runs away. The same one that when Abigail talks some sense into David and calms him down, she says, we know you're the next anointed king. And despite all of this, it's over in David's mind. All the promises, all the assurances of God are gone.
He's simply worn out. Brethren, this is when I start looking at David and go, okay, you know, he's human. Maybe I see me a little bit. How often has it been, perhaps in our own lives, that we have been worn down by the attacks of Satan? It's been one discouraging piece of news or information after another. Or we have stretches in congregations. We had one several years ago where we lost, it was something like 10 people that were either relatives of the family that were really close or were members of the congregation within about 14 months. I mean, it was just devastating. There were some other things that were taking place and the congregation just had to finally pull together. But it just got to a point where we just kind of looked at each other and we were like, well, what else is going to happen? And it's easy during those times to just get so discouraged. And if you've ever been there, well, David was there. The man after God's own heart. And all that David focuses on is what he thinks about in the moment. And in the moment, it's not the promises of God. It's what he just thinks is he ought to do, and let's just run away. And so him and his 600 men, they do that. They run away. But did you notice where they go? Look back in verse 4, the statement says that it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath. Now, I think there's some interesting irony here. The land of Gath, where have we heard that before? Well, several months ago in that second lesson, when we talked about that man who took those five stones and he went to go fight the champion of the Philistines, the one who put the bargain out there, if anybody kills me, then we'll be your servant. But if I kill your champion, then you'll be my servant. Where was Goliath from? He was from Gath. Now, remember, they still sing songs about the victory of David over Goliath. How bad does it have to get for David to think that the place he's most welcome, the place that's best for him to go, is the hometown of the guy he's known for killing? It's got to get pretty bad. David goes to the land of the enemy, is what he does. And he doesn't just like, we're going to spend the night there. He stays a year and 4 months, according to verse 7. This is not a temporary residence or a temporary solution. He's planning on staying there, but God would have other events to take place that would cause him to move. Here's what David has done in his mind. He has delivered himself by his own hand. And brethren, any time we try to take matters into our own hand and we use our wisdom and our counsel, we end up in the land of the enemy. And that's exactly what David has done. He's given up. The promises are gone. He's now dwelling in the land of the enemy. Let's see how this story unfolds for him. Watch what happens in verse 6. And so it says this. It says, so Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Therefore, Ziklag had belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. And the time that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was 1 full year and 4 months. And David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Gizurites, the Amalekites. For those nations were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as you go to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. And whenever David attacked the land, David left neither man nor woman alive, but took away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, the apparel, and returned and came to Achish. And Achish would say, where have you made a raid today? And David would say, against the southern area of Judah, or against the southern area of the Gerbalites, or against the southern area of the Kenites. And David would save neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, saying, lest they should inform on us, saying, thus David did, and thus was his behavior. Notice, not one time, but all the time he dwelt in the country of the Philistines. And Achish believed David, saying, he has made his people Israel utterly abhor him, therefore he will be my servant forever. The king of Gath gives David Ziklag, which is interesting because Joshua 19, and actually at one time it belonged to Israel. But nonetheless, he gives him this land, and David is expected to kind of do his bidding. I mean, he's going to be working for the Philistines. He's going to be working for the enemy. And he's expected to raid Israel and Judah and attack them and attack their allies. But David does the opposite. David attacks other individuals, and particularly I want you to notice one of the groups that he attacks is the Amalekites. Kind of hold on to that name and that group. We'll come back to them. But interestingly enough, what David does is when he does this, he leaves no survivors. He doesn't want word getting back to the king of Gath that, look, I'm attacking your guys, your friends, your allies. He wants him to think something else. Here, the man after God's own heart is deceitful for a year and 4 months. Now, it's true that who he's driving out were the very people that Israel was supposed to drive out when they first went in the promised land. And that's who he is destroying and driving out. But David's still lying about it and being deceitful. And so as he does this, him and his 600 men continue to slaughter day after day, and the king of Gath thinks, this is great. I've made Israel hate him. Well, that's not the case. We're skipping over chapter 28 again. There's a lot that happens there, but it's really not pertaining to David. It's about more of the downfall of Saul. And we get to chapter 29. Brethren, you don't stay in the land of the enemy without allowing the land of the enemy to affect you. And I think it does. I want to make a claim here in chapter 29 that this is kind of Adam's commentary on chapter 29. But I think there's some good evidence to suggest this, so take it for that. Israel and the Philistines are going to do battle. So what's David going to do? Well, what we would expect David to do is go back to King Saul and say, look, you know, I know we have our differences, I know we have our problems, but certainly I can't do anything against you. After all, David had had chances to take Saul's life and hasn't done it, so that's what we expect him to do. That's not what David does. David and his men instead join ranks with the Philistines. They are intent on going to battle against Israel. But that's what verse 2 says. Chapter 29 and verse 2. And the lords of the Philistines passed in review by hundreds and by thousands, but David and his men passed in review at the rear with Achish. So they're with the king that they know. But there's a problem. In verse 3, the princes of the Philistines said, what are these Hebrews doing here? And Achish said to the prince of the Philistines, is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me these days or these years? And to this day I have found no fault in him since he defected to me. Because David's a pretty good liar, apparently. But the princes of the Philistines are not having it. They said, this guy's got to go. They go on to say, make this fellow return that he may go back to the place which he has been appointed for him. Do not let him go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become our adversary. For with what we could reconcile himself to his master, if not with the heads of these men. So the Philistine men kind of think, look, this is not a good deal, because what happens if this is the plan all along? And he's here, and now what he's going to do is try to make amends with King Saul by attacking us in a very vulnerable position. So they tell the king, you got to get him out of here. And so what do we expect David to do? Well, we expect David to say, well, it's a good thing, you know, crisis averted. I don't have to face Israel after all. Whew, I'm so glad about that. No, that's not what David does. In verse 8, David says to Achish, but what have I done? And to this day have you not found in your servant as long as I have been with you that I may not go out and fight against the enemies of my lord the king? He says, no, I want to do this. And there's no reason why I shouldn't do this. Nonetheless, they are persistent. And David and his men leave. And again, here's why I want to make an interesting note. If David's plan all along was to somehow not fight against Israel that day, but really attack the Philistines, then what would he do? If his plan was that here Israel is about to have a very important battle and it's not looking good for Saul and what's going to take place, then what would David and his men do? Well, they would simply leave the Philistines and they would go to Israel and they would fight for them. But that's not what David does. They go home. He leaves Israel and Saul and Jonathan, his close friends, and his brothers. He leaves them at the battlefield, and there will be a slaughter. You don't live in the land of the enemy and it not affect you.
I don't know if he'd have killed Saul or not. But what I do believe
is that perhaps he would have assisted the Philistines enough where they could have. David's not thinking like we've seen him at any other time. And so David is upset.
But it gets worse for David. You remember the Amalekites, that group of people we had made mention of in chapter 27?
As one of the groups that he has invaded and he had destroyed and slaughtered them and he would wipe out all the people and so that nobody would know what was going on. Well, that part of David's plan appears to have failed. Somebody knows. Because the Amalekites come calling for David's family. Notice what it says in chapter 30 and verse 1. And it says this: "It happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had invaded the south. And notice Ziklag, and burned it with fire. And they've taken captive the women, those who were there, from small to great. They did not kill anyone, but they carried them away, and they went their way." I think the Amalekites, no doubt, are having retaliation. I don't know how they found out, but somehow they did. And what a heartbreaking passage we have here in verse 4 of chapter 30, where it says, "David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep." I would suggest to you that if you've lived any amount of time at all, that we have all had those moments. David is not just sad and says, "Well, guys, it's going to be okay. God's going to work this out." David cries and he weeps until he can't. You've been there? I mean, it takes a monumental event, like the death of a loved one or death of a close friend or something like that. But that's where David and his men are. They weep until they just cannot weep anymore. And then it gets worse. David can't go to Saul. David can't go to the Philistines. David can't go to his wives and his children because they've been taken captive. The only people he has on earth is this 600 men, and they're not the best reputation. And they want to kill him. David's got no one. You look at chapter 6 and the first part of it, David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him because the soul of all the people was grieved. Every man for his sons and his daughters. David finally hits rock bottom. He won't experience this kind of a grief again, at least it's not recorded in the scriptures, until we get the events that unfold with Bathsheba and the death of that child. We won't see David this low again until then. He's got nobody. Then, finally, after a drought of several chapters, what do we finally see David do? We haven't seen it in some time. David finally turns to God. Finally, he does. Verses 6 through 8. "But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. And David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, please bring the ephod here to me. And Abiathar brought the ephod to David, essentially saying, like, okay, I need to talk to God. I need to know what he wants me to do. And David inquired of the Lord, saying, essentially, what do you mean to do? There's been a long time in 1 Samuel since we've seen David talk to God. But we finally have it. That's what living in the land of the enemy will do for you. As we close our lesson, let's make a couple of quick points of application. Then the lesson's going to be yours. You know, as we said, this is not a part of David we typically talk about, right? We don't have cutouts of David's grief that we give the kids and they bring home. We forget about this. But brethren, there's so many great applications. A man after God's own heart will still have problems in their life. They'll still have lows. And that's what David has. I think about Paul. Paul certainly had that. We've been studying the heart of Paul in our Sunday and Wednesday night classes. Derek Thomas. And one of the things that we've talked about over and over again is the kind of courage and the faith that he had and all the things that he overcame. But there were still moments where Paul was in fear. and he struggled. And if David struggles with that, if Paul struggles with that, well, so will I, and so will you. What decisions do we make in the land of the enemy? When we rely on ourselves instead of relying upon God, how often it is that we turn to the world. We don't listen to God. We have problems in our marriage, we'll go to Dr. Phil instead of God. What do we expect to get? Are we going to stop praying as David did for some time? Will we succumb to our fears as a man after God's own heart did? The problem that you and I know is sometimes the issue is that we run from our problems. And brethren, we all do it. We all run from our problems. Matter of fact, you might have done it tonight. We're great about doing this in the church, right? It goes something like this. So you see somebody at services, you walk up to them and you say, "How you doing?" And what do we lie and say? "Great." When inwardly, we are drowning in fear and doubt. I know, I've been there. About 7 or 8 years ago, about the time of the birth of my first son, brother, I don't know what all the cause, but I don't know if it was just because of everything that was changing or what, but I went through a stretch, a year or two, of doubt. And it's hard to get up and preach on faith when your life is doubt. And I held it in because, I mean, as a preacher, first of all, who are you going to go to the congregation to talk to about doubt? But secondly, I was afraid what would happen if people knew that I had doubt and that I wasn't sure. But finally, when I went to somebody and I talked to somebody in the congregation, it was like the walls came down. Multiple people in the congregation were having the same issue. And you know what it did for us as a congregation? It opened things up. And so therefore, we didn't have to hide behind our problems and run from our problems. If somebody came up, "Hey, how you doing?" It didn't have to always be, "I'm great." When sometimes the answer was, "You know what? I'm struggling. If David will lose his way, a man after God's own heart, and forget the promises of God, then so will I, and so will you. And brethren, maybe that's never been you, and I hope it's never been you. I hope you've never experienced that. We were talking about in a Bible class in Thomasville several years ago, and we were talking about overcoming fear and overcoming doubt and that kind of thing. And I had somebody said, "Well, I've never had that." I was like, "Well, good for you. That'll help me." But I know some who have. And they know what it's like at 2 o'clock in the morning when you can't sleep. And you're wondering about your salvation. And you're wondering, what else have I done or not done? Or what could I do? And you're reading the passages, but you're asking, "Do you believe it?" You know, "I can't go to that other person. They're not going to relate." But now this one can. Brethren, we're all going to have problems. If David did. If David is convinced in his heart, "There is nothing better for me than to run away." And that's going to be us. And that's when we need one another. It's when you encourage one another. We don't need to run to sinful activities to try to soothe us or distract us from the reality of the situation, as so often is the case. We need to go to the very promises that we so often forget. And we need to remember that this physical life is not what it's all about. And we have a disadvantage as a country that is certainly blessed. And I'm so thankful for our military and for the freedoms that we have. And as was mentioned by our brother in the prayer, I'm so thankful for those things. But brethren, I think sometimes the disadvantage we have is because we live in such a land of abundance and freedom that we kind of just get caught up in that sometimes. And we think that that's just what it's all about. That's not what it's about. Jason Cicero, you might know Brother Cicero. He's preached a lot of different places. Years and years and years ago when I was in college, he held a gospel meeting there in Tuscaloosa. And he used this phrase. I probably sent him a check for how many times I've used it in a sermon somewhere. But his phrase was this. He says, "It's not about me and it's not about now." And that's the truth of it. You go through the scriptures and you look at those in Hebrews 11. They were willing to die
Because it wasn't about here, and it wasn't about now. It's about living for something else. And that's why we can have contentment. Contentment is not just being happy all the time. It's being happy despite the horrible things that are taking place and the sorrow and the sadness that we're going through. And that's why those in Hebrews 11 were such great people of faith. Or the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 talks about the difficulties we go through. And he says not that God will keep us from them, but that God will allow us to go through them so we can help somebody else who's going through a difficulty. We live in a time and age of a health and wealth gospel that says that if anything bad happens to you, well then what did you do wrong? And that's not true. That's not true. Rather, we got to be quick to pray. For some reason, David doesn't pray. There's no indication in Scripture that he does. He doesn't call for the ephod. He doesn't call for the priest. He doesn't go to the very one that can find strength and he can find comfort in. He relies on himself and his own wisdom. And how easy is it for us to abstain from praying? We get caught up in it. Perhaps we fail to see the good in it. Or we're quick to call other individuals. We're quick to do other things in our physical life. But spiritually, we don't talk to our Father. Helps us focus on the problem, but more importantly, prayer helps us to focus on the one who we ought to depend on. Third, we're almost close to wrapping up, is this. David took matters in his own hands. I mean, that's the only reason why I think we find chapter 29. David's explanation of these things would be, I think I can do it. I'm tired of Saul. I'm tired of what he's doing. Maybe this is the opportunity God has provided. And it was. That battle against Israel between the Philistines was the opportunity that God was going to provide. Because when you read in chapter 30, it was a Philistine arrow that would be let loose, but not by David and not by his men. But a Philistine arrow would go and it would strike Saul and it would wound him to the point where Saul knew that it was all over. When David finally gets out of the way, he finds in chapter 31 that God had already prepared the time and the place. And it wasn't up to David to determine what that was going to be. And how often is it that I need to know that? To not try to thwart God's plan of what I think should take place. We have difficulties that come up and we have situations and we know what the Bible says about them, whether what I should do in my marriage or how I should raise my kids. And here's the difficulty I'm facing and I'm thinking, well, that sounds good, God, but right now this sounds a whole lot better. And which one am I going to choose? Do we have the faith and the patience to follow God's plan? Sometimes that's hard to do. Do we have the faith to trust God when things are not going right? Or are we going to run to the land of the enemy? Last point, lesson's yours. We are never too low to not be able to come back. Look at where David is. How could God still possibly want him? Could you imagine this scene if it played out today in our political environment? I mean, again, remember, who are the Philistines? They are the sworn enemy of Israel. What would it be if a person was running in the office of the President of the United States and we discovered that they had gone and tried to help North Korea undermine the United States and that person comes back to run? Would that ever go over? No. But we'd be done with that person. We can't use them. We don't need them. David goes from joining with the enemy to making his way back, and eventually, as Saul dies, David becomes king. Because God can still use him. Because Israel needs him. For a year and 4 months, he's in the wrong place, living like the Philistines. But he could still come back to God. His decisions were never bad enough that he could not find strength in the Lord. He would have to repent. He would have to change. We'll see certainly that he'll do with Bathsheba. What takes place there? We read Psalms 51, as we will in several weeks, and we'll break it down and we'll see the humble attitude that David had, and that's why he's a man after God's own heart. Not because he went to the enemy, but because he came back. And that's the greatest lie and the most successful tactic that Satan so often uses against us, is that you can't go back. God can't use you. God doesn't need you. And it's such a lie. It's such a lie. We've been studying 2 Samuel on Sunday mornings, and this morning we looked at 2 Samuel 18. And David is either in his life as he's dealing with the problems of Absalom. Do you remember what he says to Joab and his men, his commanders of his army? He says, "Deal gently with my son Absalom." Right, that, as a father of three boys, that breaks my heart. Because you hear the father's voice coming out. And I pray that if we raise our boys to love God more than anything else, I pray that we can do that. But I pray if the day comes where they ever falter and they go away from God and I'm not there, I pray there is someone who will deal gently with my son and bring them back to God. Because they're never too far gone to come back. No matter what we've done or the decisions we've made or the time we've wasted or the amount of wickedness we've done, we can change and come back. Let's conclude by remembering one quick story. And you've been very patient, and I know we've gone a little longer than I've intended, but I want to share one quick story, because if we don't get anything else out of what happens with David in the land of the enemy than this point, then brethren, I feel like we've kind of missed the most important point of the whole lesson. In Luke 15, Jesus, as he has been ridiculed for being with tax collectors and sinners, tells three stories. The story of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. Now, you know it as the story of the prodigal son. And I think and maybe what we ought to do is realize that so often when we've told the story of the lost son, our emphasis has been in the wrong place. We have made the story out to be about the lost son. That's the wrong title for this story. This is the story of the loving father. He's the hero of the story. It's not the boy. And you and I have been in enough Bible classes to know that the father in Luke 15 is God. And that's Jesus' point. I heard somebody before services reference Bill Hall. And Bill Hall does a lesson from this that I just couldn't possibly live up to the ability he does. But I want to share one thought with you that I think brings this point home, that Bill mentions in his sermon when he preaches it. He certainly talks about the far country, and he talks about what would happen and why the son goes there, because he certainly would never want to do these things around his dad, because his dad would never allow it. So he's got to go far away. David went far away. You and I go far away. We don't engage in sin and sinful practices around our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ, do we? And yet, what this man does is he finally comes to his senses and comes back, and it's the picture of the Father. And you know what's interesting about that picture is I think as any father would realize when you read that story, is there any person in here who possibly thinks for even a moment that that father who saw his son coming down the road, it was merely by accident? That, you know, like every day he goes out and he's working in the fields and he's taking care of the chores, and he just so happens one day to look down the road and he's like, "Well, look, here comes my son." Is there any father in here that would act that way? That you would just go about your daily life as if nothing was going on? What would you do if your son was lost like that? You would be looking down that road every day, wouldn't you? Every day. And what you would do is the same thing that I think I would do, which is the same thing I think this father does in Luke chapter 15, is that as you look down that road every day, every time somebody was coming, your heart would flutter just for a half a second. Because what would you say? Is that my boy? And as it got closer, it would be probably the neighbor, you know. And I'm sure the father would be happy to see the neighbor and welcome him in, show him hospitality, and send him on his way. And then he would look down the next day down the road, and here somebody comes. And he would look and he would say, "Is that my boy?" But it would be a traveler coming through. And he would welcome him in, and he would show him hospitality, and then he would send him on his way. And day after day, after every single person that came through, it would be the same thought. And finally comes the day where here somebody comes, and he looks, and he says, "Is that my boy?" And then as he begins to see how he walks, maybe his heart begins to get a little faster. And he goes, "He kind of walks like my boy." And then as he gets closer, he says, but I don't know. You know, he doesn't look like him from here. Because the last time I saw my boy, he didn't look like that. He looked healthy. He had some meat on him. And the one who's coming now, that doesn't look like him. And I would never put clothes like that on him. I'd put nice clothes on my boy. When he left, he was well dressed. But the one who's coming now is not. And he probably smells him just about as much as he sees him. My boy's he would smell like that. And the closer that he gets, the more he begins to realize, "Well, wait a minute, I think I see my boy." The boy's been in the land of the enemy. And the land of the enemy, as it always does, changes us not for the better, but for the worst. And he recognizes finally it's his boy. And what does he do? He runs down the road at this shell of a son, and he grabs him and he says, "I told you what was going to happen when you left. Didn't you know better? Didn't you listen to me?" Anybody think that's what he's going to do? Nope. Isn't that what we do when people are lost in sin from the Lord's church? And isn't that how we welcome them back so many times? "I told you." Isn't that what we do? He grabs him. He kisses him, not because he's had a bath. And he embraces him, and he takes those filthy, ragged clothes off of him and the stench from the land of the enemy, and he puts his best on, and he rejoices. Rather, I didn't do Luke 15 justice, but that's what David does. David comes back to the Lord, and things work out for him, and it can for you and I. I don't know where you are. I don't know. I don't know who in here is still in the land of the enemy, who's been so close to it, who feels like they've been gone so long that they couldn't possibly come back. But you can come back. And the Lord will welcome you if you'll but come to Him. Can we help you come to Him tonight? Can we encourage in any way to obey the gospel or make your life right with the Lord? David lost his way. So have I. If you're lost this evening, please come now as together we stand and as we sing.